From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what makes Macomb County, Macomb County?
People like to vote for their own ethnic candidate. Certain families have dominated in this county. If you have a good name, it's gold here.
It's the gift that keeps on giving if you're a journalist.
A Detroit charter school teacher tells us why she's so opposed to Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education.
There are no rules to the game. There are no rules, and Betsy DeVos is trying to make it so that there continues to be no rules for charter schools.
And a Trump supporter explains why.
I think a lot of times a Democrat has a voice, and when we voice our opinion, I think we're labeled and we're ostracized. And it's just not right.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Republicans on Capitol Hill begin to make good on their promise to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, Michiganders who rely on Obamacare are angry and alarmed.
And if you just repeal this without having something equitable to replace it, people in this country are going to go bankrupt.
Then, corruption and scandal continue to plague Macomb County.
It always baffles me how these local politicians think they can get away with corruptions and things like sludge hauling contracts, and they pretty much always get caught.
We look at the so-called craziest political county in Michigan. But first, the presidential inauguration of Donald J. Trump happens this Friday. All week long, we're talking with Michigan residents who believed in the president-elect's message and finding out what resonated with them during the campaign and how they'll measure success with the new administration. Renee White from Manistee voted for Donald Trump. Stateside's Lester Graham recently spoke with her.
When did Trump first get your attention?
Just around the RNC. Kind of got my attention beforehand, wasn't sure where it was going to go. Kind of keep my hands off for a little bit. Voted in the primary, of course.
What about it made you decide he'd be the best person as president?
I looked more into the history of who Donald Trump is. Not him as the apprentice, not him as anything else than a businessman. The kindness of his heart, the things that he's done to people and for people in the past, just showed me a compassion that he has. I never saw anything controversial as far as, you know, things he had said or done. You know, and when you look at a candidate, you try to look for someone who's good and honest and trustworthy. And just before the RNC, I told my hubby this was going to be the one. This was going to be the one that's going to go. It's going to make a big difference. And I think I'm right. I really do.
I understand you're a substitute teacher and a mom. What issues are important to you?
Issues that are important to me is just that my kids can survive without, you know, I'm at 50 years of age. I have four kids living with me still, not able to make it on their own. I remember coming out of school and being, you know, just plain and simple, being out of school and being able to survive on my own. I mean, I lived on my own from the time I was 13 on without a problem. My kids can't seem to make it, you know, on their own. And I just think that's a really, really bad place for them to be. And more kids are living at home. I think that's just disgraceful.
You've attended his rallies. You met Donald Trump. Are you usually active in politics?
I am not. I went hugely on this one. I must say, when the second election for Barack Obama came in, I was a little bit more involved, but not as much as I was with this one. I went gung-ho on this one. I seen a huge chance for change for my kids. I seen a huge chance for change just even for me and my hubby.
So what do you take away from those rallies or the moment that you met him?
The moment that I met him was really pretty powerful. I have to tell you, I was crying. I'm very compassionate about being able to survive on my own, being able to live off the grid if I want to or whatever. And I've gotten to the point where I've gotten scared about the government and the overreach. So I was crying. He actually came right in front of me, lifted up a bunch of these people, had their cards over me. He lifted it up, looked at me, and I was crying. And he said, "I've got this. Don't worry. I've got it." And he blew me like three kisses. And this relief came over me because I thought, this man is confident. He knows something we don't know. And he's got this in the bag. And I really believe, you know, he went to those places that needed to be heard. He went to the people that needed to be heard. He went to, you know, and reached out to those people, and that made a huge difference on everything that he did.
I understand you knocked on doors for the Republican Party. What did you learn from talking with voters about Donald Trump?
The main thing that I saw, most people didn't want to tell you if they were Republican even. They were scared. And
scared? Why?
You know, just because of the I mean, even nowadays, I still get it on Facebook. You know, if I get on Facebook and start talking with, you know, my old teachers or my old peers or anything like that, you know, there's a lot of them that are still not for Trump. And I think they're going to see a big, huge change. But, you know, I wore my shirt proudly. I put signs in front of my yard. I had dog crap put in my mailbox. You know, there comes a point in time when you take a stand for things that sometimes the other people don't respond, and that's all right. But I just hate the fact that we don't have the same voice. You know, I think a lot of times a Democrat has a voice, and when we voice our opinion, I think we're labeled and we're ostracized. I mean, and it's just not right.
I'm told you started using Twitter because of Donald Trump. Tell me about that.
Just around the RNC time, I started using Twitter. I know that he was on it. I actually had heard an interview that his son had given Eric Trump. And when the RNC came into town, I was doing some Periscope and everything on there using Twitter. I surrounded myself. I went from zero to I've got over 4,000, almost 5,000 followers. And all are like-minded. You know, I mean, there's a couple of trolls out there and stuff, but they're people that I can actually go to. It's not, you know, like when I go to Facebook, it's my friends, it's my family. It's not people that always think like I do, and I don't want that. I want a little bit of whatever, but I don't want to get tore down every time I speak out either. So I surrounded myself with Twitter and, you know, put the word out whenever I could. And Twitter, by far, as far as news goes, I think on most parts, they were almost a good week ahead of it. Sometimes the stories you had to filter, you had to look, you had to research, but I'm proud of him for using it.
Well, generally, information that doesn't get looked at, examined, and verified does move faster. That's one of the problems that we have.
Yes, it is. But if you're smart enough, you can research it, you can look into it, and I think when you do that, you're better.
Donald Trump often criticizes members of the news media, most recently calling CNN fake news. So what do you think of that? And when you don't go to Twitter for the latest information, where do you get your news?
I am faithful Fox follower. And even on there, I have issues that there's different people that are back and forth. I listen to Fox News religiously. There's a lot of I've followed Sean Hannity for years. You know, and he always has a little bit more of a conservative view and everything else. But I think that some of the mainstream media, and I won't say everybody, there is a lot of a one-sided view. There's a lot of, you know, their thoughts and feelings. And when you report the news, I think you're supposed to more report the news, not your thoughts, not your feelings. I mean, you can interject a little bit of that. But when you start delegitimizing a person based on something that you can't back up with facts, that's wrong. Look at how much time they spent on Benghazi or any of the other facts. They never did it. Instead, they tried to tear him down peg by peg. And I'll tell you, the people saw it, and it's because the people are getting smarter, and they're not believing. And I think this has been 8 years of we're fed whatever they want us to be fed, and people just got fed up with it.
What are things that you'll be watching to gauge how successful Donald Trump is as president?
Well, I'll tell you what, in 8 weeks, I've seen more in 8 weeks, and he's not even on the docket yet, than I've seen in 8 years. The things that I will look at truly, fully, is the fact, will he follow through with the promises? There was a lot of promises made. There's a lot of just backed up, I don't even know if I can say it, but BS. As far as where the government is, and when I see this, when I see the things that he's doing already with the jobs turning around, with, you know, things coming back to our country, that's amazing to me. That has been a problem for a long time. And that's why kids can't get a job. That's why they can't get anything that pays enough. That's why, you know, the economy is so bad. That's why there's, honest and for truly, there's seven of us living in one house, income coming in from everybody. And, you know, when they said there's not probably a family out there that could probably come up with $400 if they had an emergency, Unless it's the payday, that's our house. We don't have any money in savings. We don't have anything. We're living paycheck to paycheck, just like 90% of the Americans that are out there. And it's hard. It's rough. You know, everybody's chipping in. I make the kids pay $200 towards rent or whatever and help out. But, you know, that's rough. If you have to live like that, that's just really rough. And when I see these changes being made, I know that my kids have got a future, and I'm a lot more secure. And I will be watching him. I will be watching him close. I mean, I will put pen to hand, and I have. I wrote him letters already. I sent them to Trump Tower. Right away when I got on Twitter, I got Eric Trump and I got Donald Trump that, you know, retweeted my tweets or interjected into them. I think that's pretty important as an American to see that my president can look at that and go, hey, you know what? I agree, or I disagree, or whatever. I want that. And most Americans do.
Renee White is a Donald Trump supporter and was one of the Michigan voters who helped Mr. Trump get to the White House. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much. You have a great day.
What does Detroit have in common with Budapest, Hungary, Wellington, New Zealand, Dakar, Senegal, Santiago, Chile, and Yerevan, Armenia? All of the cities have been singled out as a top unexpected food destination by National Geographic. In the words of the venerable magazine, the city, better known as a center for automakers, is revving its culinary motors. National Geographic heaps praise on a number of Detroit districts, including Corktown, Midtown, Greektown, Hamtramck, and Dearborn, and on area restaurants serving up everything from fried bologna on a waffle to salt cod fritters to the classic Detroit Coney Dog. You can find the full story at the travel link on nationalgeographic.com. And of course, this comes right on the heels of Detroit earning a shout-out from the New York Times as a top worldwide travel destination for 2017. Up next, a Detroit charter school teacher tells us why she's so opposed to Betsy DeVos as the Secretary of Education.
Just looking on the track record of education in Michigan, I do not believe that it would be a good fit.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. West Michigan's Betsy DeVos is going through a confirmation hearing today for her nomination as Secretary of Education. DeVos, of course, is a longtime Republican donor and an ardent supporter of school choice policies, school voucher programs, and tax credits for businesses that give private scholarships. Many who support charter schools were delighted by her appointment, but not everybody. Tashawn Harden is a science teacher at Detroit's Cesar Chavez Academy, and she's a vice president of the Michigan Alliance of Charter Teachers and Staff. She's with us now. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little, if you would, about your teaching career.
I've been a science teacher at Cesar Chavez Academy for over 13 years. It's my first teaching job, so I don't have any other experience, only in this charter school.
So you're part of the growing charter landscape, if you will, in Michigan. And you write that for you, in your words, the nomination of Betsy DeVos is a personal affront. Why is that?
Very much so. As a charter teacher, or as a teacher that teaches in a charter school, I'm finding that in the educational landscape of Detroit, there are many for-profit charter schools, and for-profit charter schools are prioritizing money over students.
And you've got clear ideas of reforms that you think would help students, but that you feel DeVos has spent her energy and money fighting those reforms?
Very much. I was a member of the Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children as well. We worked hard to create policy recommendations for charter sector oversight so that we could have real consistency and accountability in Detroit's charter sector. And in the end, she paid Michigan Republican members of the Senate and essentially killed that package.
Yes, that was a bipartisan agreement, right?
Very much.
What would that agreement have done? If those recommendations had been adopted, how do you believe that would have improved things for the kids?
What it would have created was a Detroit Education Commission, which would have been responsible for the opening and closing of charter schools. So let's say a charter school was not performing well, they would have a certain clear, transparent number of steps that they would have to follow, things that would make sure that they were being successful schools, and if they were not, then that school would be closed down. But there would definitely be some sort of central oversight, and that's what we don't have right now.
So as a result of that, what do you think the impact is on charter school classrooms all through Michigan?
The impact is we have many schools that are open, many schools that are not successful, and they remain open. Then the for-profit management companies can open additional schools when they're not successful in actually running a charter school.
You point out in Medium.com an opinion piece, and you're kind of noting that communities are suffering as these schools open and close so abruptly.
Of course. One thing that I've noticed is that every school year students ask, are you coming back next year? They're expecting teacher turnover. They're not expecting the consistency and stability that students need in order to be successful. If a school closes abruptly, then the students need to leave, and they need to find another place where they're comfortable and where someone knows them, where they can be successful. And that's just happening all over the state. There is no charter oversight. For-profit management companies can open schools and close them and open them and close them, and that's destruction for the educational opportunities for students. And if that's happening in Michigan already, boy, I would hate to see what happens in the country.
Tishan, how much does it bother you and other teachers knowing the potential Secretary of Education has never taught and neither has she sent her children to public schools?
It bothers me very much because oftentimes when teachers go into the profession, they have education in their heart. For the most part, a lot of the policies are being made by people who have never set foot in the classroom. And we've gone to school for this. We're professionals. We have the background knowledge and we know what's best for students. Oftentimes we're left out of the conversation. And everything that is brought down from the top affects us. But no one is actually an expert or has that experience, and Betsy DeVos is one of them.
What do you believe that Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos would mean for education in America?
Just looking on the track record of education in Michigan, I do not believe that it would be a good fit. I'm finding, again, the educational landscape in Detroit itself, where we have clusters of schools, and then there are areas where there are no local schools, but there's no oversight. There are no requirements and recommendations, and there are no rules to the game. There are no rules, and Betsy DeVos is trying to make it so that there continues to be no rules for charter schools.
With a complete and unassailable Republican majority on Capitol Hill, it probably looks good, as you and I are talking now, for this confirmation to go through and for Betsy DeVos to become our next Secretary of Education. Is there conversation among teachers, among administrators of, well, then what? What kind of strategies might be talked about in order to kind of brace for this?
I think what we're going to do and what we are continuing to do is what we've always done. We're still going to be there in the classrooms. We're still going to do what's best for our students, even if the policy or lack thereof, because we're finding that there are a lack of rules, we're still going to go into the classroom and do, you know, what we need to do because we know what's best for students.
Tishan, if you were on that Senate panel at today's confirmation hearing, what question would you like to ask Betsy DeVos?
I know that she said she thinks that every student deserves a fair and equitable public education. How does she feel that that would be provided? If there are no private schools in the area, what if all of those choices that, you know, that she wants to include, what if they're all full? Then what?
Tishan Harden teaches at Detroit's Cesar Chavez Academy. She is a vice president of the Michigan Alliance of Charter Teachers and Staff. We want to thank you so much for being with us on Stateside and sharing your views with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're told by the Health and Human Services Department that some 20 million of us have gained health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. President-elect Donald Trump has made repealing and replacing Obamacare a top campaign pledge. Just what if Congress and President Trump go ahead and repeal the Affordable Care Act? How might that affect families who rely on the ACA for their coverage? Today, we continue our week-long look at the Affordable Care Act in Michigan. Jerry Eisler of Farmington Hills and his family are watching and wondering about the future of the ACA. Jerry's with us now. Thank you so much for joining us on Stateside today.
My pleasure.
Now, you are a Vietnam veteran, 69 years old.
I am a Vietnam veteran. I'm from Denver, Colorado, and I've lived here for 42 years.
Tell me about your work history and when and what kind of medical coverage you've had.
Well, if I back it up, that I could say that mainly my whole life, other than the military, I was in the Blue Cross system. When we lived in Denver, my dad was a mailman. I had a sister that died of heart disease. She had myocarditis, which is a virus of the heart. So she was ill for 3 years. She died at age 16. Had he not had Blue Cross, we would have been bankrupt. I moved here when I was 27 years old when we got married. Gussie, my wife, and I have been married happily for 42 years. I was always in the Blue Cross system. I worked for Reynolds Aluminum. I worked for Castle Steel in Dearborn. And when I made a decision that I wanted to go on my own in 1984, my younger son, Mark, was 3 years old, and my older son was 6 years old, Aaron. We were fine. I was able to join an association plan for the metals group. I think my younger son, Mark, was born with Crohn's disease. Mm. He was misdiagnosed since he was a child. They said he wanted attention. They didn't even know anything about Crohn's disease. And finally, when he was in high school, he was finally diagnosed. He is now 36 years of age. He has had 7 abdominal surgeries.
Mm. So pre-existing conditions matter an awful lot to you and your family.
Absolutely.
So where do you stand now? I'm interested how things changed and what led you to the ACA.
Well, what happened was our association plan was in effect. I have neuromuscular disease. And at age 61, I stopped working. I was in the metals industry for 40 years. And when I retired, I went on disability. We had apartments in Walled Lake, and I worked until age 61. And then my doctor said, my U of M doctor, Zach London, said my neuromuscular doctors to stop working. So I stopped working. I was able to go on Medicare. And in 2010, our association plan was canceled by Blue Cross because of the Affordable Care Act. And my wife, Gussie, and my son, Mark, went on a Gold Premier plan through Blue Cross. So there was no loss of coverage, and I went on a Medicare plan. The Gold plan was terrific. It was a max $10,000 out of pocket a year. There was no lapse of coverage.
So it was seamless for them?
Seamless.
So no, you didn't feel any of the problems that some have experienced?
Right. But yeah. I will say this, that we had an association plan that we could not make any changes to. It was 50-year-old. Probably we had about 85 or 90 members in our association. And as they got older, they went on Medicare plans. But down to the end, there was probably only 5 or 6 of us left on this plan. And we were always very fearful that we would be canceled and what would happen with the pre-existing conditions. Because at the time, individual policies of Blue Cross, let's say that Blue Cross would have canceled us. An individual policy, if we went to an individual plan, you would have to wait 6 months before you received any benefits. Number two, $1,500 a year in drug benefits, which my son probably uses in 2 weeks now, and $1 million lifetime cap. I think he's notoriously close to $1 million right now, and he's 36 years of age.
So what were your thoughts throughout the campaign, Jerry, as you would hear Mr. Trump vow to repeal Obamacare as soon as he possibly could?
As long as they had this plan, I figured it was going to be like Medicare at first was rough. Part D of the drug plan under Medicare was rough. I felt that over time—
It would smooth out?
That it would smooth out. But if you have a protectionist Republican Party that just says that we want to repeal and replace, and quite frankly, if you say to people, what is Obamacare? They don't even know what it is. They don't know that it's the Affordable Care Act. They have no idea. I know people, so many people that are retired like myself, that don't realize that once you get into the donut hole in Blue Cross. So let's say if you're in a Blue Cross system, after $3,300 of what the plan pays and what you pay, you go into the, quote, donut hole until your out-of-pocket expenses is $5,000. In that period, you'll get a 50% discount on name brand drugs because of the Affordable Care Act. That was not even mentioned in the election. All the seniors like in Florida that voted for, they have no idea that if they're taking a lot of drugs, wait a minute, I take a drug called Cellcept. It's $3,000 a month. When I go in the donut hole, it's $1,500. They pay half. The Affordable Care Act pays half.
People don't realize this.
But what do you say to those critics? And they're out there, people who say, like in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, no choices on the marketplace. Prices have gone way up. People who have had their health insurance that they were perfectly happy with canceled because they didn't meet ACA standards. So people who say the ACA has been a nightmare, what do you say to them?
I say to them that I think that changes have to be made, and I realize that in the rural communities, there's very few choices. And it is that way. And I know I have friends that own businesses, and I know that coming up, they're supposed to have, you know, the mandate that you have to have all your people have to be on insurance. But we live in a civilized country. I served this country. I was in Vietnam. And I think it's a right of people to have insurance. I realize that it doesn't reach everybody. Changes have to be made. But the majority of this country are covered by plans at work. My son with Crohn's disease, mm-hmm. Both my sons are dentists. He can't get life insurance. He can't get health insurance. You know, he gets health insurance, but if they quit that, he won't get that because of pre-existing conditions. You can't get disability insurance. What are we going to be doing? Culling the herd here? So we have to have it that it is available for this 22 million. I'm told it's like 150 million people in this country have some sort of pre-existing condition. It's a lot of people. But they have to make it right. They have to make it fair. I realize that if people don't have coverage, we have friends in Arizona that the only thing available under the Affordable Care Act is an HMO. Everybody else has dropped out and consolidated. But here in Michigan, it's such a relief for us that my son works full time. He missed 6 months this year because he almost died from this horrific disease, but he has insurance available to him. The premium he's paying is $10,000 a year. I think it's going up to $12,000 a year for him and his son. In 2009, in our association plan, his premium was $21,000 a year. My wife and I, our plan in 2009, the association plan, our premium was $33,606. We had years of increase of 25%. If we had 10% a year in increase, we were happy. But the problem is individual policies. That is the whole problem. If you work somewhere and you work for a group, but if you're an independent contractor, which my son is, mm-hmm. you have a problem.
What would it mean to your family if Donald Trump, once he's sworn into office, makes good on that campaign promise? What would change in your lives?
My son would go bankrupt, and we would probably go bankrupt because he needs care. I mean, if you go into the hospital, to the emergency room, the emergency rooms used to be packed. So if you go in there, they're going to stabilize you. You see the commercial all the time, Humira. Mm-hmm. The drug costs around $3,000 or $4,000 a month. They're not going to give you that drug in the hospital. You go to the hospital, they're not going to do it for you. So somebody is going to go bankrupt, and it's going to be him, and it's going to be us. And I don't know what's going to be. And it's a deep concern to us. We've been retired for 8 years, and I had to retire because of my medical condition. But if he didn't have insurance, we are out of our mind over this. In fact, I'm telling you, I'm barely talking to the people that are conservatives right now that voted for this guy. I'm so upset because of the health care.
If you could talk to him, if you could have a conversation with Donald Trump, what would you want to get across to him?
I would say to him, you know, just repealing things is easy. Nobody has come forward with some sort of a plan. If Donald Trump is willing to listen to people like myself and saying, okay, if you want to move it across state lines, make insurance available across state lines, that maybe my son could be covered of Anthem Blue Cross in Denver instead of Blue Cross and Blue Shield in Michigan, and make various changes. But he's indicated that he'd like to have pre-existing conditions. He'd like to have kids be able to stay on their plan for 26 years. They have the congressional will with the Democrats and the Republicans to make the necessary changes to make this work. And, you know, if there was something that cost my son double, just let it be available. But to have nothing is a nightmare. What do you do with everybody sick? I'm not going to let my son die. So I'm going to do everything I can. I probably get broke in the process. But it is the number one thing. I am 69 years of age. The number one thing that concerns my wife and I is not my health. It's my son's access to health care. He is going to work. He doesn't want to go on any kind of the doles. He doesn't want to go on Medicare. He doesn't want to go on anything. I probably have neuromuscular disease from Vietnam. I would never make a claim. There's far sicker people than I am. They should get everybody that serves in this country that goes in the war zone. When they come back, give them a Medicare card. This is what the people in this country deserve. But he deserves access. And if you just repeal this without having something equitable to replace it, people in this country are going to go bankrupt.
One of the over 20 million Americans relying on the Affordable Care Act for health coverage and watching very closely what happens after Donald Trump takes office. Jerry Eisler, it was great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up next.
It's the gift that keeps on giving if you're a journalist.
We'll talk about just what makes Macomb County, Macomb County. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the immortal words of Michigan Radio's senior news analyst Jack Lessenberry, it may just be the politically craziest county in Michigan, if not the planet. Jack is talking about Macomb County, the third most populous county in the state, a county which continues to churn out headline after headline, from its sheriff who went to prison for rape, to corruption surrounding a waste hauling company, to the racist and sexist recordings plaguing Warren Mayor Jim Fouts, and the list goes on and on. So let's talk about Macomb County being Macomb County. We have Jack Lessenberry here with us. Jack Lessenberry, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And we welcome longtime Macomb County journalist Chad Selweski. Hello, Chad.
Hi, good to be with you.
Jack, your recent column for the Toledo Blade, love the headline, Macomb County Politics in a Class by Itself for Weirdness. Why do you think this was the time you wanted to lay it all out?
I think it was just a combination of things. You had, of course, the Mayor Fouts follies, you might call them that. The fact that Macomb County was very instrumental in Donald Trump's narrow victory in Michigan last year. He won it almost five times the amount he won it statewide. And all these other shenanigans that you mentioned. They had some very, as Chad can tell you, some very strange characters elected to county offices. And it's just the gift that keeps on giving if you're a journalist.
Chad, you have lived, you've worked in Macomb County for so many years. Is this a long track record of weirdness, or have things amped up in recent years?
I'd say a little of both. We've had our share of, as Jack said, some quirky characters for 30 years at least. But the last couple of years, I'd say it's amped up some. And a good part of that has to do with Fouts. Jim Fouts, I think, with some degree of confidence, basically believes that he's unbeatable. He can control the city. He can control the council. And in that case, he is free to engage in wherever his ego takes him, and he is just not able to rein himself in.
He's got some justification for that. After his follies that Cindy was talking about with his assistant in Chicago, he got reelected with something like 85% of the vote.
Yeah. You know, the tape that came out in 2013 showed him on a profanity-laced rant, wishing that he could beat to death one of his political foes. 2 years after that was that 85 to 15% margin.
Hmm. And then, of course, these recordings of Mayor Jim Fouts allegedly saying some really horrendous things about African Americans, older women, people who are intellectually challenged.
Yeah.
I would guess in maybe another part of the state, somebody would be stepping down by that point.
Resignation is not something that probably even enters into Mayor Fouts' mind. In fact, he tried to claim that the voice on the tape wasn't his. I don't know that anybody believes that, but he's sticking to that story. Fouts' behavior, I think, just leads to politics in other cities and other races where some people think that regardless of what outrageous things they say, that's in bounds, they can still get elected.
To give everyone a sense of what it is that makes Macomb so unique and so colorful, Jack, some of us can remember when it was a really sleepy county with a lot of truck farms on Hall Road, where now you see one shopping strip after another. Who tended to settle in Macomb and why?
Well, there was sort of, Macomb, as you say, used to be sort of farm country, and it had Mount Clemens, which was sort of a resort where people went to take the waters, believe it or not, back in the 30s and 40s. But then after World War II, when Detroit started emptying out, blue-collar workers, white ethnic people of Italian and Polish extraction tended to go east to Macomb County, whereas the more white-collar workers went to Oakland County. In 1960, Oakland County was solidly Republican. Macomb County was the most Democratic suburban county in the nation that year. But, of course, we've had political changes since then. To some extent, though, I think that some of this is sort of a mystery. There's something, it's a mystery to me, while, you know, in a lot of other counties, Oakland, for example, Wayne, Irish names predominate. In Macomb, it's Polish and Italian names. And there's a political culture there that evolved in a way different from other places. And I'm at a loss completely to understand why.
How would you describe that mindset in Macomb County?
Jack's right. Macomb is a mystery. Every time someone thinks they get a handle on it, 2 years later, things have changed. The Macomb voter is kind of a maverick, kind of independent-minded, a lot of ticket splitters in Macomb. A lot of it is they just like to shake things up.
We saw that beginning really with a big splash in 1980 with the Reagan Democrats.
Yeah, they don't like to be pigeonholed. They don't like to be seen as the minions of any particular group, whether it's the Republican Party, the UAW, anybody. So there's a lot of renegade kind of attitude among Macomb voters, and it drives the politicians here crazy because you never know what to expect. As far as where we got right now, you have to realize, too, that the county keeps changing. The demographics keep changing. It used to be, as you said, kind of a sleepy bedroom community. More recently, it's growing like crazy in the North End. And these are Oakland County-type subdivisions, large homes, not necessarily McMansions, but that just adds to the stew that we have here, the political stew, where we have a lot of different types of people living here.
Well, I think Chad's exactly right. I used to describe it as a layer cake. If you go up to Armada, if you go up to the Ray Township in the northern part of the county, you might as well be up north. If you're in Warren, the southern half of Warren, you could easily be in Detroit. It's layered and every layer is different. But I want to say the characterization sometimes of Macomb voters as a bunch of racist white rednecks isn't fair. In 2008, they voted overwhelmingly for Obama, and Obama won the county again in 2012. Mitt Romney didn't do much for them. Macomb Community College is probably the finest community college in the state. It's no accident Obama went there a couple of times. Its outgoing president, Jim Jacobs, is one of the intellectual lights of Michigan. So this is a very complex county.
Do we see the kind of Teflon effect that you've been describing with Warren's Mayor Jim Fouts? Do we see that with other political leaders in Macomb, Jack?
Well, yes and no. I mean, old-timers like Chad and me can remember David Jay, this very bizarre state senator who was eventually expelled from the state senate. And at some point, Macomb voters had had enough of him, too. You could write a book on his shenanigans. But you mentioned, of course, the sheriff who went to jail for rape. The voters then elected his son, sheriff, who is now the county executive, Mark Hackle, of course. I should say that Mark Hackle claims that his father got a raw deal. And however, it's not normal when someone goes to jail for something like rape, a public office holder, that the voters would then instantly elect his son as successor. It's kind of like if the American people had elected Trisha Nixon after Richard Nixon had to resign. So I think there's a loyalty to names, I think. I wonder what Chad thinks about that.
Oh, there's definitely a name game that's played in Macomb. You talked about ethnic names. We've had, at certain times, 3-4 family members all in office at the same time. And even in basically the same office, we've had 2 Vivianos on the circuit court at the same time, 2 Switalskis on the circuit court at the same time. It's kind of a throwback. It's fading, but people like to vote for their own ethnic candidate. Certain families have dominated in this county. If you have a good name, it's gold here. Perfect example is the county treasurer's race we just had. A guy by the name of Larry Rocca, no relation to Sal Rocca, Sue Rocca, or Tory Rocca. Those all three have been popular politicians in the recent past. He's tried to cash in on the Rocca name for over 2 decades, and all of a sudden, without making much effort at all, in November, he won the county treasurer's race.
Answer me this, Chad. I understand that, but it seems to me the Macomb voters elected a county clerk who I think most people think might not be qualified to be a greeter in a hardware store.
Yeah, we talked about Fouts winning 85-15%. The woman who got the 15%, Karen Spranger from Warren, won the county clerk's race against Fred Miller, a county commissioner, former state rep, well-respected, was endorsed by the outgoing clerk Carmela Sabaugh, who had been there for 24 years. Everyone viewed it as a shoe-in for Fred Miller. Karen Spranger, who has no government experience, pretty much known as a gadfly. She used to go to city and township meetings to protest smart meters, DTE smart meters, dressed in a foil outfit and a tinfoil hat. And she got elected county clerk over Fred Miller. People around here are still shaking their head trying to figure out how in the world that happened.
And doesn't she live in a house without running water and which she owes vast amounts of property taxes?
Yeah, she's been fighting in court for years to try and avoid paying property taxes, claiming that she doesn't live there. And apparently she even went to the extent of shutting off her water to try and convince people that she doesn't live there, even though there's evidence that she does. She's a very eccentric person.
Moving up at the top of the heap, we mentioned County Executive Mark Hackle. And is he not mulling a run for governor, which would lead the rest of Michigan to ask both of you, what kind of county executive is Mark Hackle?
Well, he seems to be a very popular one, I'll say that. He seems to be fairly well regarded for efficiency. I think he had a good record as sheriff. But my question would be, what party would he run for governor representing?
Yeah, that's Mark's problem. If you went back 2-3 years ago, he was mentioned constantly as a future governor. He runs as a Democrat. He has a lot of popularity with Republicans, but he constantly refuses to be a party man, a loyal party person. Until the Flint crisis, he was very close to Governor Snyder. He has endorsed other Republicans, most notably Candace Miller. The idea that Mark Hackle could win a Democratic statewide primary, that idea has kind of faded away because, you know, in a primary, there are just too many loyal team players that would shun him immediately.
Well, outside of Macomb, certainly. I mean, he'd win Macomb, whatever he ran as. I wonder why Hackle would want to run for governor. He can sort of be county executive in Macomb until his heart stops beating, as far as I can interpret things.
Could be the Elbricks Patterson of Macomb County, definitely.
We're talking about Macomb County being Macomb County with all the political craziness as we talk with Michigan Radio senior news analyst Jack Lessenberry and longtime Macomb County reporter Chad Selweski. Well, we have to talk about corruption and perhaps what is viewed by many as a climate of corruption, and probably a really good place for that to begin is the Rizzo waste hauling probe. Chad, remind us again, just who are the players, what has happened, and where do you think this will go?
In October, there were indictments that came down against two officials, Dean Reynolds of Clinton Township, who was a trustee running for supervisor. The Macomb Township person who was indicted was in a little different situation, a trustee who had lost in the August primary and was on his way out. The curious thing here, though, is the FBI very specifically told the media that this was part of a deep probe into Rizzo Environmental, their trash hauling contracts, and the idea that they were offering kickbacks to officials. The implication was many Macomb County officials. Since those first two indictments, it's been silence. And I'm really curious what's going on behind the scenes there.
And when that shoe may drop?
It could be that the FBI was trying to smoke some people out, trying to scare some people, get them to come forward and be an informant and cut a deal. But it does seem strange that there was this flurry of activity. And now, months later, nothing has happened since.
Jack, is there a culture of corruption in Macomb County?
Well, that's a bit strong. I think you may see more incidents of it in this county than some other places, but I don't know how that would be hard to quantify. I'm curious, there's always corruption along sludge hauling contracts. I mean, you know, we remember Monica Conyers in Detroit, Wayne County went to jail over that. When I get caught with corruption, I want it to be for something cleaner, you know, something a little classier than hauling sludge. But it seems to somehow, I just don't quite understand it. But, there's a lot of things I don't understand. I don't know if you could quantify that. It seems to me we've seen a lot of incidents of that, but there's also a lot of media there. Macomb County, unlike Wayne and Oakland County, is still growing demographically. I think that one factor might be that it didn't have a county executive till relatively recently. Wayne and Oakland had county executives for a long time, so it'll be curious to me to see if there's a maturing process, if Macomb County is a different place 20 years from now. Chad might have more insight into that than I do.
Well, one of the reasons why I've been told why corruption tends to pop up in trash hauling is that, for one thing, there's a lot of money in garbage. There's huge amounts of money. Rizzo is a company that grew from nothing to a very successful company with, I believe, about 24 contracts across the Detroit area. In a lot of communities, people don't realize this. The biggest contract that the municipality gives out is for trash hauling. And these companies push for long-term contracts. They push for extensions. There's real cutthroat competition there. There's also been a situation, I think what probably first brought the FBI to take a look is there were situations where Rizzo would not get the contract and then would object to the process, suggest a different process, and second time around, bingo, they get the contract.
This will be interesting to watch play out. We can't talk about Macomb County without talking about what to many was the political oddity of a U.S. congressperson deciding to step away from a very secure seat and run for the Public Works Commissioner, which Candace Miller did and won. And, Chad, we've seen some major house cleaning begun already, haven't we?
Yeah, that was no surprise at all. The Morocco team has been together for quite some time in most cases. And I think Candace Miller was probably itching to get rid of those guys as soon as she stepped into office and try and get a clean start. Now we see that getting a clean start is obviously not going to happen. She referred to it the other day as a baptism by fire because of the massive sinkhole that she's now dealing with, state of emergency evacuations, tens of millions of dollars to fix that broken pipe. I find it kind of funny that when she made her announcement, everybody in the political world was scratching their head saying, drain commissioner, public works commissioner, that's just a sleepy little job where you don't really do anything. Then she ends up in the most expensive race for a county seat in state history, a very nasty race. That was followed by a huge tragic situation of statewide significance.
Yes, and that's a story that will be unfolding with the sinkhole. I know you did a great piece, Chad, in Deadline Detroit, talking about the series of these sinkhole disasters, and you say this is an egregious example of failing sewer infrastructure ignored by authorities again and again.
Yeah, if you look at the court documents, it's pretty infuriating for the average taxpayer, the average ratepayer, because we've had four times where that sewer line has collapsed, going all the way back to 1978. And each time officials were warned that there were a lot of problems down there, bad soil conditions, you need to do inspections repeatedly, it just never happened.
Jack Lesenberry, what do you think the rest of Michigan should take away from all of this that we've been talking about in Macomb?
It always baffles me how these local politicians think they can get away with corruptions and things like sludge hauling contracts, and they pretty much always get caught. So I think there's maybe a cautionary tale there. And there's also, I think that to some extent, Macomb County may not know what it is in the sense that Oakland County knows what it is. And I think it's in sort of a process of finding itself. It's kind of, it's a spread out county, as we've said. There's a lot of different factors and factions, but it's coming up on about 850,000 people. So I think we should watch it with interest and maybe sort of try to avoid some of the excesses. But Macomb County has some pluses too.
Michigan Radio senior news analyst Jack Lesenberry, we want to thank you, and we want to thank longtime Macomb County reporter Chad Selweski. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
And even as Warren Mayor Jim Fouts continues to insist it is not his voice on those audio recordings making disparaging remarks about African Americans, older women, and people with intellectual disabilities, the chorus of voices demanding he resign is getting louder. Today, a statement came out from eight Macomb County politicians, federal, state, and county level, all of them calling on Fouts to resign as mayor of Michigan's third largest city. Fouts posted on his Facebook page today insisting, I will not resign. And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.